Wednesday edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast, 15 and 60. Got the first half of it for you on the Eastern Conference today, Atlanta through Detroit. We're sponsored today by the letter S. Oh, wait, no, that's Sesame Street. But we are sponsored by Stamps.com. You can get a free 4-week trial using my offer code CAPSPACE. And CISO, 1 month free of great comedy at CISO.com. So, you know the drill here. Let's get started with the Atlanta Hawks.
The Hawks are 37-30, 5-7 since the last one of these that we did. They are 26th in offense, 4th in defense, the Memphis Special, negative 0.5 net rating, but they're basically a lock for the playoffs. 538 has them at greater than 99%, and they're projected to be 5th in the East with 45 wins.
They picked up Ersan Ilyasova at the trade deadline for a somewhat convoluted exchange of second round picks, but they gave the Sixers a better second round pick than they would have had. Since the trade, he has played well himself, 13 out of 28 on three pointers, 5.9 net rating, which is good, as you mentioned, that they've not been playing well since the trade in the aggregate. His usage, as you would expect, down from his Philly days. He was 24% in Philly. They have a few more threats in Atlanta, so now he's at 18%. And he's mostly been a spot up guy. That's the big appeal of him, but he does get into the post on mismatches on occasion, once or twice per game. So that's helped. Do you feel that he is a player? I mean, granted, he's been traded, what, 5 times now in the last year and a half or something like that. Do you think he's a player who doesn't get enough respect, or is he pretty much just properly rated?
I absolutely feel he hasn't gotten enough respect. Think about the difference that he made on the Sixers for some of that time. And granted, a lot of it was also that he played with Joel Embiid, and Embiid was playing really well, but I thought that they meshed very well together. And we've kind of seen that at a few of his recent stops. And not only would he have helped Oklahoma City, a subject that we talked about when they made that trade for Jeremy Grant, but I think he would have, theoretically, if Orlando hadn't done the Ibaka trade, he would have been a nice backup for them.
Yeah, I mean, he was really, when we talked about Tobias Harris being traded for nothing, it still basically was nothing. Because Ilyasova wasn't under contract or had a non-guarantee for the next year. Everyone expected that they would just decline that and try to get into the market. Instead, they traded him away, as you noted, for Ibaka. But yeah, I think he just, the spacing that he provides at the four, takes a lot of charges too. He's leading the league, I think, again, in charges, or if not that, he's right near the top. And yeah, every once in a while he'll flop a little bit too much for charges and give up a play. But if you're even in the position to flop for a charge, it means you're getting there, that you have an understanding of the defensive schemes and your help rotations. So despite the fact that he is very slow for a modern day power forward and may well be older than his listed age of 29, he's been a valuable player, and you know, it'll be interesting to see, again, he's going to be a free agent this offseason, what he ends up getting. I mean, I think it's going to be pretty clear that he's not a starting power forward, although he did really help the Sixers because they didn't have anyone else to space the floor. But I think he can be a solid backup 20-minute-a-game guy on a pretty decent team going forward, and that's someone who, you know, could merit something maybe a little bit less than the mid-level exception for a couple of years.
Would you like him in New Orleans as kind of the what we thought Caspi was going to be, as kind of like the third week in their rotation?
I don't think so, because they already have Solomon Hill for that, who should be the four.
Point.
And Ilyasova can't guard the three. I mean, that was the big appeal of Caspi, is some modicum of defense on the perimeter. I mean, Ilyasova is not a good perimeter defender. So no, I don't think New Orleans would be a place I would look at for him necessarily.
But I think the other thing we should talk about with the Hawks, considering we're about a month away from the end of the regular season, is the looming unrestricted free agency of Paul Millsap.
Oh man, I tried to take a bite of this protein bar while you were talking and finish it, and it is way too chewy. I have no chance of finishing up. I guess I could have just let the truncate silence do its work, but it was
that's what I expected you to do, but whatever.
It was just such a hopeless decision that I was like, all right, I'll just take my medicine on this one. It's still not as good as when you like ate an entire sandwich during a podcast one time.
I will note for the record that that was an enchilada, but close enough.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. It's, I don't know. Sandwich is just
I think I've eaten parts of a sandwich during recordings as well, though. So
yeah, sandwich is just a funnier sounding food than an enchilada.
Oh, that's true.
I think.
Plus, it doesn't make us sound like coastal elites.
I always think of that enormous sandwich, like that 3 foot long sandwich. Or no, it was like 6 feet long sandwich that Homer Simpson was eating. on The Simpsons, that he just like kept around for like 3 weeks. Must go to Duff Gardens. All right. This is not a comedy podcast, and that wasn't funny. Yeah, so the question is, with Millsap, if you're Atlanta, we know what the market realities are. He's going to get a lot of money. He might get the max. But if you just think, hey, this is a contract we would be comfortable paying him, what would the number and years on that be where you feel like, okay, this is actually like a decent value? We're not worried that this is just going to be a horrible contract.
He is a really kind of clear years, not dollars guys for the Hawks because the present value is a little bit lower. You know, like that, yeah, that is a big part of
his coverage. He'll be 32 this offseason, by the way. That's important to note. He'll be 32.
And he'll be a 10-year player, so his max will be, based on the current estimate, $35.7 million. That's a lot of money. And when you think about that, if the Hawks could give him 8% raises, that's a lot of money. As Atlanta, my thought was about maybe $390, but I'd actually like to make it decelerate, to de-escalate. And that would work a little bit better with the way that their cap goes. They still have Dwight. They still have Bazemore for a couple more years. They just signed Dennis Schroeder to that extension this year. So I think $390 would be about it. Other teams I would pay more, maybe a three-year deal around his max. I think that would be fine. And you could talk about a fourth year, but I would lower the annual value a lot if you add a fourth year. So maybe for a team like that, maybe like $400,000 or $110,000. Something in that range.
Yeah, I think that's about right to me also, just given where they are as a franchise. Remember, basically, if they have no path to cap space unless they trade guys, if they are going to re-sign it, his cap hold is about $30 million, and they would have about $30 million in space without him, essentially. I mean, you noted that max of 36, I mean, he'd be eligible for up to a five-year contract for up to $209 million. I mean, that's the same contract that the Kings blanched at giving DeMarcus Cousins under the designated player view. Millsap, no such concerns because he already has the requisite 10 years of experience to get the highest tier max, as you noted. So yeah, and this is what they kept him. They didn't trade him. You know, they were playing quote unquote well. They'll just potentially, they could even get to the second round. If I were a Hawks fan, I almost would be rooting for them to not get to the second round, just because the more success they have this year, the bigger a chance that coach Mike Budenholzer, who apparently seems to have, if not won a power struggle, at least had his voice become the one that's the most listened to. I mean, which is not a surprise. He was the president of basketball operations, but you know, I'm sure Wes Wilcox and some of the other people in the front office were saying, hey, you know, we got to take a longer view. And it sounds like Bud was like, well, hey, we're playing well, like we're just going to keep these guys around. So the better they play, the bigger, the more Millsap has them over a barrel in some ways. You know, if they just get swept in the first round, then it's like, all right, is it really worth keeping these guys together? Probably not. You know, let's just rebuild. So the reason
that matters is because I don't think the other team's offers are changing that much. I think that, you know, the Nuggets will offer probably something pretty close to the max. I have that feeling. The Wolves will probably offer a lot of money. So really the variable factor in here is what the Hawks offer, just like it was for Al Horford.
And frankly, it makes more sense for Millsap, a team like the Nuggets or the Wolves, to offer that amount of money for Millsap, because especially Minnesota is going to be in a situation where they're going to be capped out as soon as they extend Wiggins and Towns. Now they could run into some tax concerns eventually, but you know, especially if the contract were short enough, it might not be as much of an issue. And maybe something that those teams would do would be like 4-year max, but then the fourth year could be partially non-guaranteed, you know, for like $10 million or something, where it's like, all right, if you just desperately have to get out of it and you want to stretch it, it'll just be $3 million over 3 years. It won't kill you, but it still would be, you would essentially have a 3-year contract or a 4-year deal with guaranteed money of about $120 million that way, and the potential to still have that last part be guaranteed. But for the Wolves and Nuggets, it makes sense because they're trying to get to the next level. They have a bunch of other young pieces who are still cheap, and that's why it would make sense for them, because they're probably not going to be getting another free agent better than him anytime soon. This is their last chance, and the free agent market is not that robust in terms of players who are actually willing to go there. You can say you're overpaying for him, but he at least gets you up to the next level, gets your players to have some experience. He'll still be a good defensive player for the next a little bit. He can maybe hopefully improve his three-point shooting a little as he gets older still, and can be a valuable player for a while. Whereas for the Hawks, I mean, just what are you getting if you're going to bring him in other than victories that are going to keep you from getting your next star? But they're just not willing to bite the bullet in terms of rebuilding at this point. Last thing on the Hawks, Dennis Schroeder. Thought it'd be interesting to check in on where he is in the aggregate. Had some negative headlines lately, missing the flight back, not to after the All-Star break, got suspended for a game, then was late to a team flight or practice or something, and so he ended up not starting another game after that. Then he got taken out of that game against Golden State because of just an egregious error and didn't play the end of it. But he's still in the box score, looks really good, right? 18 points a game, 6 assists, 54% shooting. That's right around the league average, especially on this team that is quite inefficient. But it's also worth noting that he's 47th in RPM, not really an asset on either end of the floor. Pounds the ball a lot, turns it over a lot. And he also, a big problem for him in terms of efficiency is he rarely gets to the foul line, and he just doesn't really have a way to get there. His jumper is not good enough where he can kind of get guys trailing him over the screen and then pull up when they're on his back and get some of those BS calls that way. And all of his layups are just kind of speed layups. I'm gonna beat the guy there as fast as I can. He's not going into guys' bodies, going over or through guys at the rim to get to the foul line there either. So with all that, it's unless he is really the only paths he has to improving are just a lot better decision making, less selfish play, and then of course improving his jump shot, which has gotten a little bit better this year, but still most teams are content to go under on him. Every once in a while he'll just blow up in a game, but in the aggregate it's been an effective strategy to just go under on him.
I also think he can get better defensively. He has the physical tools to be a more consistent, I would say an above average defensive point guard. It requires effort, and he is asked to do a fair amount on the offensive end, but I would like to see it from him anyway.
Yeah, and he's so skinny too that he's just completely ineffective on switches. I mean, there's even at point guard size, there's a big difference between being like a buck 70 and a buck 90 when you're trying to just do something in the post or front the post or something like that. I will get to the Boston Celtics momentarily, but first this from stamps.com. As a small business owner, I had to go to the post office to mail stuff every once in a while, pay the bills. And in the town I live in, it's really rarely a fun experience. There always seem to be about 6 or 7 people in line. It's a 10-minute drive to get there. I've basically wasted an hour by the time I actually go there. If you forget like a box or something, or you end up buying it there and it's way more expensive. It's just not a fun experience there. But with stamps.com, you can do everything that you can do at the post office from home. They even will give you a digital scale to measure everything out. And if you're sending a package, you can actually get a postage discount through stamps.com for priority mail, first class, international mail. Just a few minutes to sign up. You can start printing right away. There's no special hardware needed at all. You can print out a shipping label and just slap it onto the box, call and schedule a pickup with USPS if you're sending a bunch of stuff. And again, get those discounts through stamps.com. It's also nice that unlike the post office, stamps.com never closes. A lot of times I'll have stuff that I need to work on after we're done recording at like 1 a.m. Stamps.com is available for me at that time. So here's how to get started with them. Use my code CAPSPACE for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial that includes postage and a digital scale. When you sign into stamps.com, before you do anything else, make sure you click on that radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in my code CAPSPACE, all one word. We talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the program, so that's easy to remember. Let them know that you came from us. That's stamps.com, enter code CAPSPACE. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. All right, where are the Boston Celtics?
It's been an interesting little run for them. They're 42-25, 6-6 since the last time we did this. They've kind of come towards each other. Now they're 8th in offense, 12th in defense after a huge disparity at the start of the season, +3 net rating, and 530 gives them a 41% chance of getting the number one seed in the East, a 6% chance of winning the NBA title, and actually has them in a tie with the Cavs with 53 wins for first in the East.
Yeah, I still think that that's probably not going to happen. It'd be nice for them if they could get there. But I think that if they were able to play Toronto in the second round, given we haven't heard anything about Kyle Lowry being on the mend quite yet, but if he's just getting reintegrated, he'll have not really played with Ibaka or with PJ Tucker for Toronto and may not be 100%. That to me is an easier second round matchup than Washington would be. or if Washington were to get the number one seed, the Cavs in the second round. The Celtics did lose a couple of games with Al Horford out. I think that Phoenix game and the Clippers game, he missed both of those. I know he missed the Clippers game for sure. But outside of that, I think they've actually been very impressive defensively. That Warriors game, they really shut them down in the fourth quarter. The Cavs, really one of the few teams that's defended the Cavs well all year. Marcus Smart, Avery Bradley has been back now since the break, looking 100%. We worried that that Achilles injury might linger, and it did for a while, but he looks like he's fine now. And Jay Crowder, of course, an excellent defensive player. Horford, solid at switching. They're still a little weak on the defensive glass, but really there aren't that many teams that they're going to be playing that are like such awesome offensive rebounding teams. Even Tristan Thompson, they did a good job on him in that Cavs game. So the fact that their defense is really starting to get to where we thought they would be is very encouraging for them. Seeing them in person last Wednesday, was there anything that stuck out to you at all, Danny?
I thought that Kelly Olynyk really has a part to play, at least for this season on the team. It'll be fascinating to see how they handle him this summer. A lot of it will be offer dependent on other guys and also dependent on what Olynyk gets offered. Like, I think they could just outright decline just because they have so much, else that they can do. Most other teams would be happy to have him, but with their specific circumstance. But his shooting, and he tries on defense, he's imperfect, but he tries out there. Like, I think he's an asset for them at this point.
He is what Frank Kaminsky was supposed to be. He actually hits his three-pointers, which Kaminsky doesn't. He's not that quick on the perimeter, but he tries. And at the rim, he actually, you know, he's not going to get out of his area because he has that T-Rex wingspan to block shots, but he's mobile enough and understands the system enough to get his chest in front of guys, go up for verticality. He had a few nice plays there. The other thing I really like about him is when teams switch, he is very aggressive about getting into the post, getting deep post position, and then finishing before the help can get there. And then, you know, he's got a good pick and pop game as well. If he's playing as he has at times on their second unit as the center, he really causes a lot of problems for traditional centers with his ability to shoot three pointers. And then if you're going to go small against him, and usually when teams go small, they end up switching everything. Now he can get into the post and be effective. He also can make a nice decision off the dribble since he has that background as a guard in pick and pop situations, or if he's going to roll to the basket on a short roll, he can make the right decision. So I think as an offensive player, he's very good. They missed him quite a bit in the playoffs when he had that shoulder surgery. He's now starting to round into form again. And, you know, he can have some possessions where he looks really ugly. He'll travel every once in a while. He's not very good on the defensive glass, that kind of stuff. You know, he's looks bad, as unathletic white guys who are centers can tend to do at times, but I think he is an effective player. You mentioned his restricted free agency. The Celtics, although they were partially screwed over by this new collective bargaining agreement, and that cap space is going to be reduced, and there are also fewer free agents that are going to be on the market because teams have more of the ability to retain their stars. One way that the new agreement did help them is by still not really fixing the issue with restricted free agents, where effectively the Celtics will have until, even if he gets an offer sheet, until July 8th to decide whether to match, and then he can just keep his small cap hold on the books until then. So that's helpful if they had to decide to match on, like, you know, within 2 days of July 2nd when he first got an offer sheet. That could be a big problem if they're waiting on someone like Gordon Hayward to make a decision. You know, usually those big players will wait until July 4th or 5th to make their decision. And so then maybe there wouldn't have been time to retain Olynyk if they get turned down by those players. But now they'll have plenty of time to keep him. And then his cap hold is pretty small. They won't have max space if they keep him, most likely, unless they were to move someone like Bradley. But they could still hold on to him to some degree. They could hold on to him and still have a degree of cap space, probably up to maybe around $25 million or so, which would get them a good player, if not, you know, a superstar.
One small point I want to make on the Celtics, just while we're on them, is that a determining factor for them in terms of getting the one seed, or really where they end up 1 through 3, is if they can win all of their games against opponents that are basically done. You know, they have 2 games against the Sixers, they have 2 games against the Nets, 1 against the Sixers, and then they also have the Suns and the Magic. And so you would say, oh yeah, they'll definitely lock in all those games. They did lose against the Suns in Phoenix without Al Horford, but clearing those out with their schedule could give them a major leg up on the other teams, which I believe do not have as many of those gimmies.
Oh, to talk more about Isaiah Thomas's season too. He obviously has been one of the best offensive players in basketball, but one of the things that struck me about seeing him in person, and I'd been talking about this a little bit more because we've done a few of their games as well recently, but just how good he is without the ball in his hands. And he is number two in the league in the number of possessions he's used on handoffs. The Celtics love running him off the ball, running stuff through the elbows. Horford, Olynyk, those guys are awesome at those kind of plays. And the difference between Isaiah running off the ball and someone like Steph Curry or Klay Thompson, who we see in person all the time, is massive. He is so fast. Like, he's like a wide receiver when he's off the ball. He can just change direction so quickly. His straight line speed is very underrated, how fast he can go, because he plays at such different tempos. But when he really kicks it into gear, you just cannot stay with him if you're trying to deny him off the ball. He's just quicker than anyone else. Like, the whole, like, oh, we're just going to hold this guy? No. He is way too quick and small for that kind of stuff to work. He's just going to break away. And on those handoffs, he's averaging 1.08 points per possession. And think of a handoff as pretty similar to a pick and roll in the idea that the guy's going to get the handoff, which somewhat functions as a screen anyway, and then roll to the basket. It's a similar action. But a handoff, if you can actually get the guy the ball, is going to be more effective a lot of times than a pick and roll, because pick and rolls, usually they can ice the guy, you know, send him to the baseline. Everyone knows the pick and roll is coming, so they can tilt the help over there. People are more experienced at defending pick and rolls. The best way to stop a handoff is just by denying it completely. But with Isaiah, it's really hard to do that. And basically, by definition, once the handoff has occurred, that's happening because you're open. You know, the defender is going to be trailing the play. And it means that you're probably going to be able to get into the middle. Most handoffs are going to the middle of the floor, so that helps a lot to get to the middle. And then the big either has to step out and trap, which leaves the guy who just did the handoff open, rolling to the basket, or he's going to be with some confusion about where exactly to go, because, you know, the ball has not been contained on the side of the floor. So that's why handoffs are so effective. The downside, of course, is that if you have a great defender like an Avery Bradley or Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, and your guy isn't that fast, then you can just can get blown up by denying him. But Isaiah is too quick to do that on. And so that's why he's just so good at those plays. And you remember 2 years ago, he got shut down by the likes of Iman Shumpert in the playoffs against the Cavs. And now, because they do all this off-ball stuff, you can't do that on him anymore. And so that's really one of the things that makes him so unstoppable. And then also, like, if you try to, like, meet him on the other side of the handoff and go under, now his three-pointer is just deadly. And so he'll just hit that in your eye if you try to just go under and meet him on the other side. So there's really no way to defend that very well, unless you just are going to switch that handoff completely. And few teams have the personnel to do that. Do you want to guess who leads the league in handoff possessions if Isaiah Thomas is second, Danny?
The first guy I thought of was Damian Lillard. I know that this back, especially when Plumlee was on the team, they would do a fair amount of DHOs with him.
He was up there. CJ McCollum also up there. They'll do a lot of those flare screens and then come back for a DHO as well. But the leader by quite a bit is actually Zach LaVine.
Interesting.
Which I never would have thought. But yeah, he's good at those because he can just come off of it and rise up. And JJ Redick also was among the leaders as well. But yeah, I mean, even though LaVine has been out for a month, he basically was on pace to almost double the second highest guy, I think, when he went out. He's still like 30 ahead of time. He's like 173. So that was a bit of a surprise. Let's get on to the Brooklyn Nets here.
The Nets are still sad, 12-54, but a more encouraging 3-8 since the last time we did this. 28th in offense, 28th in defense, negative 7.6 net rating, and unsurprisingly projected to be last in the East and last in the NBA with 17 wins.
They're still playing hard.
Yeah.
Negative 5.1 net rating since the break. So they're playing like a real team again. That has coincided with the return of Jeremy Lin, shooting 38% from three. He's getting a ton of shots up in general, 14.7 points a game in only 22 minutes. And I'm sorry, 38% from three is the entire team since the break. Lin, 45% on threes. He's taking four a game. So he's moved to taking even more threes than he did before. And the team team in general, I mean, they've been getting a ton of threes up. They've been like the Sixers of the last few years. Their shot selection is great. They never take long twos. It's just they don't have good enough three-point shooters, and they don't have good enough guys to penetrate and get those guys open. But they have been shooting it better from three. That's probably just luck. A few other things that I'll note on some of their players before we get into the main thing I wanted to talk about for them. KJ McDaniels has barely played, as has Andrew Nicholson. Both those guys have played less than 5 minutes a game since they've arrived. Nicholson in particular, seeing him warming up, I think in the first game after the trade deadline at the Warriors, he just looked like he was not at all in game shape. He's got to get back there. He just hadn't been playing at all with Washington. Quincy Acey, who was signed for the rest of the season, I think next season also, he's actually taking 60% of his shots from three-point range now. Always a guy who had a decent touch from long two range, shot a few threes in college. They've encouraged him to stretch out a little bit. He's been playing 18 minutes a game and hitting 50% of his threes since the break. Not a ton of sample there, but he's playing some minutes as a small ball center. They've looked good relatively in some minutes with Rondae Hollis-Jefferson at the four as well. But what I wanted to get into next is some restricted free agents or young unrestricted free agents, if any, that we think they should target and maybe be willing to overpay for a little bit. Their cap situation, $30 million in cap space this year, and then we'll have $60 million next year, assuming that they were not to re-sign Brook Lopez. I'm thinking the thought would be, let's sign some guys to help us compete next year, maybe the year after, or that even, you know, we would be on a decent enough contract that if they play well, we could flip them for some more draft picks, because finally after next year they will have their first draft pick in forever and they don't want to be too good in 2018-19.
The challenge for Brooklyn is the goal of getting better reasonably, but also not getting bad contracts. Like, I think that no bad contracts is a really, really hard thing to do. It's going to be easier this year than it was last year, both due to the reduced supply of teams that are offering and just the nature of this group of free agents. I feel like there are going to be guys that fall under it. And there are also some guys who are on teams that might not be interested in retaining their own players. Like Nikola Mirotic is an interesting one here. Like, I think there would be a way of making an offer for Nikola Mirotic that the Bulls just would be like, meh, you know, like maybe it's even a good offer. Like that's a big difference from last year where the restricted free agents were a little bit stronger, the ones that actually held on with their teams, and so you couldn't really strike that balance. So I would be probably a little bit more judicious. That's just the way that I would approach the Nets, because I just think they're going to get better. But there certainly could be, you can marry that with going after the right guys.
Yeah, and there's certainly an argument that, hey, let's just use this $30 million on one-year deals again, and that maybe the type of player who'd be available on those one-year deals would be a little better than they got this year. You remember Grievous Vasquez got injured again early in the year, and they waived him. Luis Scola just got waived, barely played for them at all. That was $10 million and they still are like way below the floor this year too, or not way below, but they spent a lot of the year below it. So I think they can do a little bit better on some smaller one-year deals than those guys. But if they wanted to go the route for maybe get some guys who could contribute a little bit more, there are players on teams that have shown a little bit of promise, or at least did at draft time. And then those teams are also trying to use cap space and might not want to just keep these guys cap holds on the books. So I thought Tony Snell was one. They just desperately need a 3-and-D type of two guard on this team. Snell shooting 40% on three. It doesn't do anything else, but you know, that's still a reasonably valuable player. The Bucks would probably look to re-sign him, but maybe you could get an offer that they might blanch at a little bit, because they now have Chris Middleton and they still have Parker coming back. So Snell maybe not considered a starter for the in their plans. Shabazz Muhammad would really help this team in terms of his shot creation. Ben McLemore, another guy kind of similar to Snell, not as good of a defender, maybe a little bit more potential to score offensively. Mirotic, you mentioned, I think like this team has by far the worst fours in the league, I think. They in Oklahoma City, but if you throw in Cantor and Grant and some of the other guys, it's probably not Oklahoma
City
anymore.
Now with Taj, I think they're a significant step ahead of the Nets.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, not they have Taj. They're better there. But Mirotic, especially, I think a guy who has stagnated in Chicago and would fit into what they want to do, shooting three-pointers. He also can do more. The way that they space the floor, he could actually get into the post a little bit more, drive, try to get back to his game that was a little bit more versatile than just standing on the perimeter as he's done the last 2 years in Chicago. then maybe three potential backup centers that could be an upgrade on Justin Hamilton and are younger than him too. Hamilton is a little bit older. All these guys are arenas restricted, but they wouldn't probably want to make enough of an offer sheet to have that matter. Cristiano Felicio, again, with the Bulls, I think, and Christian Wood with the Hornets, both of those guys have flashed three-point range at times. And I think the Nets, what they want to do with encouraging guys to shoot threes, that those two players could really fit into what they're trying to do and maybe be, if they can figure it out, a little bit better defensively than Hamilton, especially Felicio. And then Alan Williams, as just a bruiser guy, can get you some points and rebounds. He'll also be a restricted free agent from the Phoenix Suns. And then the last guy, I think, is fitting into that same mold maybe as Felicio and Wood, but he's older, only 25 though, and actually unrestricted, Mike Muscala from the Hawks. He's been out of the rotation since they got Ilyasova, but he can block some shots okay. He's really more of a center defensively, but can hit some threes. Again, someone who I think would fit well in Kenny Atkinson's system, and of course he's familiar with him from his time in Atlanta.
One other small point I want to make, and I will eventually include this heavily when I do a offseason preview of them for the Sporting News, is they should be the new Sixers, the team that if there are players that make a little bit too much money that those teams are looking to clear space, like let's say for Paul Millsap, that you go to the Nets and you say, hey, yeah, we'll take your guy, we want a little bit of money for it. And with the league changing the rules on the salary floor, that could also make it easier, for more palatable for them to do that right away, as opposed to saving that space until the deadline.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you can also just make the argument that, hey, they should leave space open for teams that want to clear cap space for the summer of 2018 or something, and unless they can really get a good value on some of these restricted free agents. But we'll see. It'll be interesting to test out. I think all of those players that I mentioned are going to be very interesting cases for how much their incumbent teams value them, because you can argue that all of them to some degree or another maybe have been underused, either in terms of minutes or in terms of role on their current teams, and that maybe those teams don't value them as much as, and I think all of those guys have some upside where it's worth maybe investing in them. But the nature of restricted free agency, it's tough to do that, because you either, the guy either doesn't get enough because no one makes an offer, or they have to make a godfather offer. I think the one thing, I mean, the Nets have been spurned now three times in restricted free agency. I think that their approach with the Demo deal was a little bit better. By the way, I got a little bit more of the story on why they decided to give Demo an offer sheet that the Rockets wouldn't have had to match as much money, because they gave him those incentives, and then the Rockets didn't have to match that. And so people are like, well, why wouldn't they just make that all guaranteed so the Rockets would have to match it? And basically it just boiled down to that was the contract that they're comfortable giving Demo, and they wanted to have those incentives in there to have him, you know, be a part of their program during the offseason, and that's why they did it that way. So you can argue about whether, yeah, go ahead.
And that's incumbent on the agent, you know, like that's their spot. If that's the contract that the right. Nets are comfortable with, then you either take that or you try to negotiate into something different. You can't be surprised by that being the rules, because they're the rules of free agency.
Yeah, and given how Demo has played since he's gone to New Orleans, I think that their exceeding degree of caution with him seems more justified. The fact that they decided to err on that side rather than the side of, hey, let's give us the best chance of actually getting the guy.
If he needs to take a make good deal, Brooklyn could actually be a good place for that. Oh, yeah, but they're banned from, how soon could they do
that? Yeah,
they
cannot sign him until after a year after basically they
and that went into the season,
the
that's
process,
right.
it's like December 1st.
Jesus.
Or something. BJ didn't do a very good job on that. Let's get on to Charlotte here.
Yeah, Charlotte, they are now 29-38, 5-7 since the last 15-60, 14th in offense, 8th in defense. So you hear that and you think 9 games below 500, plus 1 net rating, same thing, but only a 5% chance of making the playoffs, projected to be 11th in the East with 36 wins.
Yeah, that loss to the Bulls on Monday probably really killed them as far as making the playoffs. And now the disturbing news that Nicola Batum has been suffering from excruciating migraines the last few days, missed that Bulls game. He's supposed to be getting a CAT scan per Chris Haynes. He's to be sidelined at least one more game, if not longer. And we hope that it's nothing more than just migraines for him. But with that being the case, it really is time to break out the playbook from that 2014-15 season and warm up the tank, start giving Kemba Walker some time off. Interestingly, Walker, I figured, oh yeah, you know, he was so hot on threes at the start of the season. He's probably started falling off and, you know, he's still playing well, but, you know, there's no way he could have kept this up. And that's part of why they haven't been playing as well. Au contraire, overall in the season, 57% true shooting, 23 points a game, 29% usage, shooting 40% from three. Great defensive rebound rate for a guy who's probably under 6 foot. He's definitely a worthy all-star. And over his last 15 games, he's basically beating all of those numbers still. So it has not been anything with him as to why they've fallen off. I mean, the fact that he's played this well and that they've kind of wasted this season from him, frankly, is really disturbing. And of course, part of that was due to the fact that Cody Zeller missed so much time and they didn't have anything really approximating a decent backup for him.
I think that a good encapsulation of this season for the Hornets are two different things, one that you pulled and one that I pulled. So the Hornets are sixth in net rating since the All-Star break, but are 5-6, which is just shows it. And then I had already gone into and wanted to look at their close games because I had noticed just like they've been good this year. When I watched them, other than the Zeller time, they've been good. They're 17-26 in close games. So that's 5 points or less within the last 5 minutes. They're being outscored by 10.9 points per 100 possessions. So that's a negative 10.9 net rating. But they're eighth in offense during that time, 114.1, and 29th in defense, 125, only ahead of the Lakers in those 162 minutes.
Yeah, that's not very good at all. And it's really has been a disappointing season. They're probably going to not even make their original over-under, which we thought was one of the best bets for the over. I think they're going to fall short of that. And then it actually moved up, I think, to like, it started at like 39 or something. They probably won't even get there. And then it moved up to 42. We still like that. We thankfully did not pick it as one of our best bets once the line moved. But I think we both thought they would do better. Plumlee still out with that strained calf. And this is another one of those ones where, and especially when you consider his age too, being a little bit older, I think 28 now, he was supposed to, the big reason for getting him and taking on that horrible contract was, hey, our bench bigs, Hibbert and Hawes, are terrible. And then he immediately got this strained calf and missed it a month. And they've been horrible with Zeller out and really Kaminsky for a lot of that time is their only experienced big. He's been miscast defensively as a center, as we've talked about. And so now they've gotten none of the value out of Plumlee this year. He's going to keep getting older. If you want to say, oh, hey, he was the only backup big that we could get for this year, we desperately had to have someone, which is not a line of thinking that I subscribe to, but you know, maybe what they were thinking. Now that whole reason for the trade, even like whatever you could have said was a good reason for the trade or the best that we could find, considering I think they're all bad, but has now been obviated, and they still have 3 more years on that contract. And when we see what some like totally capable centers who are superior to Plumlee are going to get in terms of years and dollars on this free agent market, it's going to really show how bad that trade was.
Yeah, I don't really want to continue beating that dead horse, at least not for another couple weeks, but
I had in the notes.
Yeah.
when in doubt, just always go back on some trade that you didn't like and start railing about how it looks even worse than the last time you talked about how bad.
But
it is
so weird with them, just like the mix of like smart, proactive things. I think they have a great coach, and then trades that are harder to justify. I mean, I was more negative on the Bellinelli trade than most, and he's done all right for them. But so you have that, and then like letting Bismack Biyombo, you know, like basically letting him go just free instead of dealing with his qualifying offer, you know, like those sorts of things they've gotten wrong. They've gotten other big things right. And it's such a fascinating combination with that team that most organizations don't have.
They're kind of similar to Phoenix in that way, where they have a lot of good moves followed by some just completely inexplicable moves all the time. And I don't know what the situation is in Phoenix. You hear more rumblings about MJ kind of getting involved in certain moves, but I mean, I think one of the things that you can point to when a team is very inconsistent in some of its moves is the owner getting involved or not. Portland, another example of that, where I don't know about Evan Turner, whether that was a Paul Allen special, but the match on Crab, supposedly that came from Paul Allen, that, hey, we're not letting these guys get away. I'll pay the money. So I think it's interesting to look at when you see these franchises. And then Portland did a great job, obviously, with the Nurkic trade, as well as starting to recover a little bit from this awful summer. It's I think that's what you'll see is a lot of times that there are owners who will come in and kind of make the final call at times, and other times they go along with the recommendation. But that's maybe one explanation for the inconsistency in some of these organizations. We'll get to another inconsistent, or actually, no, probably more consistent organization, actually, of late at least, the Chicago Bulls. But first, this from CISO. Meet David. He's smart, jobless, and $500,000 in debt. So he decided to become a licensed clinical psychiatrist by conducting 1,920 hours worth of therapy sessions with patients he met on Craigslist. See if his plan works out on the new critically acclaimed series Shrink, streaming only on CISO. It's not only great original content on CISO, which costs just $3.99 a month after your 1 month free trial via the Capspace code, but there's also fantastic binge-worthy classics, hilarious stand-up specials, late night the next day, 42 seasons of Saturday Night Live, the entire Monty Python catalog. You can watch it all from the comfort of your favorite device. We mentioned Shrink. There are other great original series as well, the McElroy Brothers, My Brother and Me, and an animated fantasy role-playing game starring Dan Harmon, and a fake reality show created by the geniuses behind Comedy Bang Bang and Reno 911. So the way to get started with them, go to CISO.com right now. Sign up for 1 month free with that promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. That lets them know that you came from us. Get you the 1 month free. Easy to remember. We talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the program. That's CISO.com. You spell it SEESO.com. Promo code CAPSPACE. CISO.com. Promo code CAPSPACE. So the Bulls, where are they mired in this Eastern Conference morass?
I'm going to enjoy reading this combination. 32 and 35, 6 and 6 since last time. 24th in offense, 4th in defense, negative 1.8 net rating.
14th in defense.
14th, sorry.
Defense, right? Yeah.
Negative 1.8 net rating, 52% chance of making the playoffs, projected to be 9th in the East with 40 wins.
Amazing, given all the doom and gloom, that they're actually 6-6 in their last 12. They had a nice stretch and then lost 5 in a row and then won in Charlotte on the back of some pretty good three-point luck, although they did at least get 40 shots up. I had the note in here from the last time because we just kind of erase everything on the Google Doc each time. This team should be trading anything not nailed down, in all caps. And then you wrote in parentheses, probably would have been good to mention that they should get something for them too.
Hey, they listen to your advice, but they're in this just super weird place because they traded McDermott, who theoretically who would have been on the team next year. They could have traded him, and Taj Gibson, who probably would not have been on the team next year, for Cameron Payne, the other one, and Joffrey LeVern. And Payne, other than some foot soreness, I think he's missing their game on Wednesday night. He's been shaky, and LeVern has been gone. He hasn't been in their rotation.
He played for a little bit, and then he only played 3 minutes against Charlotte. At one point, Fred Hoiberg had been playing 12 and 11 man rotations. Now they're finally cutting that down. I mean, it just how inconsistent he has been, and their mission has been just over the last 2 years, and then in general this season and of late. First, he's going to 12 and 11 man rotation. Then he's going back to starting Rondo for the first time since December, and he plays well. Now he says, "Hey, we're going to go for the playoffs. We're going to pare down the rotation again." All right, they started playing Mirotić after he had a bunch of DMPs and was actually inactive. Now he's back again. He's one of their five best players. He should be playing. Now I guess they're going to try again to make the playoffs. Also disturbing that Payne is out with that foot soreness. That's the same foot that he's had two surgeries on now, or if not surgeries, two broken bones. All of this, I mean, I think if they actually play their best guys, it's possible that they could stay in this playoff chase because they do have some good players. I mean, Jimmy Butler still is really good. I wanted to ask you, though, should they move on from Fred Hoiberg? Certainly a lot of people are calling for his head. It's been reported that he will not be axed after this season, in part due to the amount of money that remains. That's from the local guys. National guys have said he's more on the hot seat. But regardless of whether the Bulls, who are famously loath to pay coaches who don't work for them unless, you know, they win 65% of their games like Tom Thibodeau, then they're happy to do it. Should they move on from Hoiberg, even if they're not going to? Should they?
If they can find somebody who is definitely, like, that they're comfortable with as being their coach of the future, sure. Yes, absolutely. Like, I'm not exactly sure who that is. I do not necessarily have my ear to, or have my finger on the pulse of coaching in that way of saying, oh, especially this person who hasn't gotten a job before. But We have not gotten any particularly potent information to say that Hoiberg is going to be or is a good NBA coach. They've defended reasonably well. His rotations have been completely incoherent. It doesn't look like the players are buying in. Like, that was an issue last year where Jimmy Butler said they need to be coached harder. It's been an issue this year in myriad ways. And so I like to think back on that of like, what is the affirmative case? And the affirmative case based on his Bulls tenure is very thin.
What you would argue is he had this pace and space system. He wants to have shooting at the four. He got handed a roster last year with two centers. The two guys who were supposed to really contribute to this pace and space were Mirotić and McDermott. And those guys just aren't that good. That's not Hoiberg's fault. He's had to deal with guys like Gasol and Noah and all. Derrick Rose didn't fit into what he was trying to do. Then this year, they signed Rondo and Wade. They picked up Grant and Carter Williams. Those guys can't shoot. He's never had a point guard who could make a three-pointer at all. He's got this lumbering traditional center. It's just they don't fit in his what he was supposed to be. It's been impossible for him to succeed. That's the argument for keeping him, and that maybe he should just get another year. They really believed in him, and if they give him a roster that fits better what he's trying to do, some younger guys, well, maybe that helps. I don't find that a very compelling argument. It's possible that that argument is true. It is. And he also would have a gripe that he, if he were to get fired, that he was kind of sold a bill of goods here and wasn't able to do things his way. That's true. I kind of agree with that. On the other hand, you mentioned all the issues he's had just from a leadership standpoint, from a getting guys to respond standpoint, the amount of drama that they've had in the locker room and that spilled out in the media since he's been there has been a remarkable amount. It's gotten them to defend okay, but and also it's worth noting last year too that he had a lot of injuries, and if Jimmy Butler didn't miss a month, they probably still would have made the playoffs. It'd been a lower seed. Joakim Noah, they couldn't really do it without him last year either once he went down. So he's got that, and the defense fell apart as soon as Noah went out of the lineup. It's just that you can't point to anything that he's done well. Like, you really can't. Like, the one thing I would say is every once in a while, they'll show off some nice little wrinkles on defense, switching away from the ball. But then, as I noted on the wrap-up of the Hornets game on Monday, a lot of times they'll just not execute that. The young guys that are supposed to develop, nobody has developed under his watch at all. So many guys have really disappointed. Now, again, you can make the argument that someone like Bobby Portis didn't really have that much talent, but he's just been yanking guys around. He does stuff that doesn't make sense in terms of rotations. Like, you remember early on in the year when he was playing Hoiberg or playing Bobby Portis in crunch time cost him a couple of games. I mean, he's probably in the top five in terms of coaches where you just like, why is he playing this guy right now? Why? Like, there's just, and it's one of those things where you can't even come up with a reason why what he's doing makes sense. So, and my general philosophy is there are a lot of coaches who are really good, and there are some who are just kind of average or below. And it's very difficult to identify who that's going to be beforehand. Hoiberg, of course, was very well respected before they brought him in. And he also, of course, is close to Gar Foreman, which helped things too. But I think that if you have a coach, I mean, I'll tell you this, there's almost no chance that Fred Hoiberg is a very good coach. I mean, would you agree with me on that?
Yeah, I think I would. I mean, it's and also, like, would you want to be the team that makes that next bet? It kind of reminds me a little bit of the early Norv Turner stuff where it's like, yeah, there's a chance that it was unfair the first time, but would you want to give him 3 years to figure it out?
So, yeah, you can't identify that reliably sometimes who's going to make a great coach, especially if someone has never coached before. But just take another bite at the apple when it's clear that your guy is not a very good coach. And I think it is clear at this point that that is Hoiberg. Fair to him or not, you know, he hasn't been put in the best position to succeed. And if you had to evaluate who's done a worse job over the last 3 years, coaches or management, I think you would clearly have to choose management if you were the Bulls. But yeah, it's just, there's no evidence at all. Like, even just like his press conferences, like, he doesn't really sound very smart in his press conferences. He's very deer in the headlights. He just looks miserable and beaten down too. You know, he's not even like a rah-rah type of guy. You know, he's not giving you that type of enthusiasm either. You know, they're like, oh, hey guys, we're all going to get out of this. Like, let's pull together. Like, he doesn't even provide those sort of platitudes even. So yeah, I think they should move on from him after that long-winded explanation. Let's move on to Cleveland here.
A team that succeeded after changing their coach. They are 44-22, 7-6 since the last time, which is surprising in its own way. Third in offense, 22nd in defense, +4 net rating. 538 gives them a 51% chance of getting the top seed, 6% chance of winning the NBA championship, and they're projected to finish in a tie with the Celtics for first in the East with 53 wins.
Interesting that you mentioned Ty Lue. David Griffin went on Zach Lowe's podcast from Sloan and talked a little bit about making that change for Lue. And he said, yeah, it was definitely risky. I owned that decision to make the change. But think of how many teams didn't make a change and you'd never know if they could have played better. I think that's interesting to look at it from that perspective as well. And we've talked about this a little bit before, but there's just something about coaches, and maybe this is just because they have some lobbying power in the media or whatever, where it's like firing. And I think maybe even just because we all grew up playing four coaches that we are just told we inherently have to respect. And that even after we're out of that, a lot of people just gravitate towards this idea that the coach is the sacred figure. And then if, you know, college, it's even more ridiculous than in the pros. But there's just something about like, oh, it's like this guy got fired, somebody did it, they did him wrong, blah blah. And then, you know, Briante Weber gets cut from the Warriors, who I think he probably deserved to stay. Maybe they had to move on from him because they needed to get, and they were cutting him for Jose Calderon too. It wasn't like they knew about the KD injury at that point. Or, you know, some player gets cut and nobody cares, you know, and the player, these coaches are fine. Usually they're fired with guaranteed money still in their contracts. A lot of time players are cut and that's not the case for them. So it's really weird how we just have this thing in our society where coaches are somehow sacred and they're the ones always getting screwed over if they get fired.
Well, and there's another point I want to make here, which is very important. Their salary doesn't count against the cap. So it isn't the same circumstance even. It's dead money that is really just out of the owner's pocketbook. It's another strange way that there's all this sympathy, whereas dead money, like for a player or something else, like that actually affects making your team better.
All right, let's actually talk about the Cavaliers now. They struggled a little bit, had a rough game that we did Twitter NBA show second screen in Houston, but I thought they played pretty well offensively in that game. That was just a great game. A very interesting game too, just from the standpoint that probably on 70% of the possessions, there were switches involved. And then they just had to figure out a way to attack switches. Both those teams, ton of three-point shooting. They tied the NBA record for most three attempts in a game between two teams with 88. I thought it was just a very interesting look at the current state of the NBA. Two teams that really are with stars, great three-point shooting, how hard that is to guard, the way that teams are trying to attack that, try to deal with it defensively. So they've been struggling a little bit, and then they come out and make 23 of their first 26 shots against the Pistons and just completely blow them off the map. And that's what you remember about this team and why, even with the Warriors having Kevin Durant and being at full steam, the Warriors would be great favorites in that with the healthy Durant. I don't know if he's ever going to get back there this season, even if he does return. But this team just has guys who are completely unstoppable. And here's a few stats to back that up. Kyrie Irving is shooting 62% at the rim. We know that that's awesome. Obviously, for a point guard, that's above league average, and he's 6'1". 39% on threes, and most impressively, 48% on two-pointers outside of 10 feet. That's ridiculous. Unbelievable. And then you consider that only 20% of his two-pointers are assisted. So he's not shooting 48% on twos like Jason Smith style, where he runs a pick and pop, you throw it back to him and he's wide open. Even Dirk on his twos in his heyday, a lot of those would be open because it was the result of a pick and roll. He is just beating his guy, crossing him up, making him look stupid, and then hitting a jumper in his eye, and he's shooting 48% on that. I mean, that is just an incredible level of efficiency for those shots. I mean, there are very, very few players in NBA history who can shoot that type of a percentage on long twos that you're just creating by yourself. It's unbelievable. And then LeBron is shooting 39% from three, and less than half of those are assisted. So he's actually shooting a lot of off the dribble threes and making them, a lot of those in ISOs off of switches. And he also had dropped off a little bit with his finishing at the rim. Now that they just have so much shooting, I mean, remember last year, for a lot of the time, they were playing, it'd even be playing Mozgov and Tristan Thompson together. They're playing with a traditional center a lot of the time. This year now, they always have four great three-point shooters on the floor, and a lot of times it'll be five when they're playing Fry at center. That's what I would describe his incredible finishing at the rim back up now to just historic levels. 77% is completely ridiculous, and again, you know, it's not like he's just getting dimed up at the rim for a dunk. Like, he's creating those shots a lot of times himself.
That combination is why I'm less worried about them in the playoffs, I think, than most people are, just because those spectacular individual talents. I mean, LeBron's three-point shooting is not necessarily going to continue. It might, we don't know. But Kyrie can get those shots even when the refs change their whistles and everything else. Like, he can do that. And I think their defense can be better than it's been. But I've always kind of had the line in the sand for me as being around top 10-ish. Like, that you need to play at that level. It doesn't mean you have to be a top 10 defense the whole season, but you need to be capable of reaching it. And I think that's what could be their undoing, theoretically.
There's an interesting stat that was pointed out that only three teams have been below the top 10 in defense and won a title. And I think that those three were the Rockets in 95, the Lakers in 01, and there's one other team that escapes me at the moment. But all three of those teams were defending champions that had shown the ability to play better defense, especially that 01 Lakers team started to play ridiculous defense in the playoffs and had been good the year before. So I think there is something to believe that they can make it back, but they also have some new players this year as well. I mean, they really are going to need J.R. Smith to be a two-way option on the wing, because I think Shumpert is not good enough with his three-pointer. He's too inconsistent. Deron Williams has played well, I think, in a complimentary role, 59% true shooting, making a few more long twos than you'd like so far. He's been shooting a great percentage on those, only 30% from three, 29% assist percentage, which is good for a backup point guard, only 15% usage. He's been closing some games a little bit, but he's not the solution on defense in particular. He's a liability at either guard spot at this point. So they really need JR back, and he is going to get back there, I assume. He's looked like close to his normal self, even though he hasn't been starting these first couple of games back. So yeah, I think that they can get there defensively, that they're going to be good. Yeah, they're 7-6 over their last 13. That's fine. You know, they'll be okay, I think. Little update on Chetty Osman, who they drafted after trading the pick that became Tyus Jones in the 2015 draft. He is supposedly going to come over a second round pick, number 31 in 2015, this offseason, or at least will be available to from his contract. His stats have looked good. I haven't actually had a chance to watch him on film yet, but I was impressed in watching him in some of the international competitions with just his feel for the game, ability to get out in transition, make smart passes, drive on closeouts. And he's shooting 42% on threes in the EuroLeague. He was in the high 30s last year as well. And as a guy who's still pretty young, I think he's like 21, 22, 19 minutes a game, 8 points a game in the EuroLeague when they really are favor a lot of veterans. That's actually pretty decent numbers. So I don't want to say he's going to be like, you know, come over and be playing right away for them next year, but I think if they can get him signed into a contract, maybe they would give him part of their mini mid-level exception next year, that he could be someone who'd be good for them in 2 or 3 years. Like, I think he's still looking like a solid asset just based on that, on those stats and what I saw from him a couple years ago. Not the number one expert on him, but I haven't seen anything in his statistical resume to say, oh, this guy isn't going to be any good. So that's encouraging.
It'd also be interesting to see if maybe they went the Luis Scola route and traded him to somebody else for an asset that could help them. I think that's an outside possibility as well.
The Detroit Pistons. Surging Detroit Pistons,
33-34, 7-4 since the last one of these, 22nd in offense, 11th in defense, negative 1.3 net rating, 63% chance of making the playoffs as of this moment, and they're projected to be tied for 6th in the East in a three-way tie for the last three spots with the Pacers and the Miami Heat, which will probably change by the time we do the other two teams in the other 15 and 60.
Yeah, that reminds of, I want to say 2006, when like the 6th seed only had like 41 wins in the East, and there are a bunch of ties. You talked about the handoff possessions from Isaiah Thomas. KCP is in the top 10 in the league in handoffs as well, shooting a very nice percentage. A lot of those are threes. Reggie Jackson, you know, has still been up and down, at least had a good game against the Bulls where he killed them on pick and rolls late. The Pistons overall, though, still have that negative net rating since the break, even if it seems like they're playing a little bit better. I think they lost their first couple right after the break, and then we did the 15-60, and then they went 7-4. For Andre Drummond, he's up to 41% free throws, which shockingly is actually an improvement. You know, you can now at least say we're more likely than not to get at least 1 point when he gets fouled. That's not horrible. And I looked at the minutes distribution they've had in the clutch, because you remember a lot of times last year, due to the Haka, they would just have to take Andre Drummond out of the game. And it looks like the rule, which is now you can't foul in the last 2 minutes, has helped. This season, I looked at the number of clutch minutes that Kentavious Caldwell-Pope has played. That's 91. He's always going to be out there in those situations. So he's played 91 minutes in the clutch. That, of course, is a five-point game in the last 5 minutes. Drummond has played 75 minutes, so pretty close to the amount that KCP has, and Baines has only played like, you know, 15 or something. So Van Gundy is trusting him a little bit more in the clutch, and perhaps that anti-intentional foul rule and his slightly better free throw shooting maybe has helped as well. I also took a look at where they are in the clutch since Reggie Jackson returned, basically December 1st. And he's played 54 clutch minutes during that time. Ish Smith has played 23. So despite all the talk that they're better with Ish, and maybe they are, San has still been trusting Reggie more in the clutch. RJ, not exactly deserving of that based on his clutch performance. 11 of 39 from the field. KCP has been unbelievable in the clutch, even though they've not been a good clutch team overall. 20 out of 35 in the clutch since December 1st. And 13 of 23 on threes. He's actually hit some really big threes at times in the clutch this year. Also noteworthy, we said Jackson, 39 field goal attempts. KCP, 35 during that period. 9 field goal attempts for Andre Drummond during that period. And only 4 for 12 from the free throw line. So it seems pretty clear that what they're doing is they're just not passing it to him. Because if he gets the ball, he's definitely going to get fouled. And two little questions I wanted to talk to you about. The first of those is, are you just going to make the assumption that Drummond's like not really going to get any better than this? Have you reached that point with him?
Yeah, I think back to something that I think it was Kevin Pelton that is the one who really turned me on this, about the idea how athleticism generally always tones down from when a guy reaches, you know, like his early 20s. It's just that the intelligence and skill level outpaces it for enough time, and then eventually they start that tapers off, and then that leads to guys going down. With Drummond, that really kicks into another gear because he hasn't developed as much from a skill perspective. I do think he can get better defensively, so he can improve in elements, but his overall impact, I expect at some point his rebounding will drop at least a little bit, and that will hurt his value a lot because he is
and it has actually elite. Already a little bit. Yeah.
Like, and when you
on the offensive glass,
when you are that elite at something, when you are just the best of the best at something, and then you drop off, you know, a little bit, then it takes away a big marginal advantage. And with him, he derives so much value from that it's, I'm concerned about that, but I do not close the door on anybody with his physical talent. I think that somebody that he can, I just don't expect it.
He's only 23. So, but it really seems like he's been at the same level for a while. I agree with you. He can get better defensively, and overall their defense has gotten a little bit better in the Van Gundy era, and I think he's a part of that. I was more thinking really offensively. I probably should have specified that. And I mean, that's something that I've been talking about for a while. You mentioned the idea of your pure athletic prime, which I would say is between 22 and 24. And actually there was a panel, one of the guys from Catapult was on at Sloan, where that question was discussed, and that's what they said as well. And those are guys who would know at Catapult because they do all this tracking. Say that, yeah, you're really in your pure physical prime at 23, 24, if not your prime as a basketball player. So yeah, I don't think he is going to get better. I mean, he's slightly better on free throws, but again, there's really no record whatsoever of a player who is as bad as him on free throws even getting to be passable. In the post, he's shown this kind of weird touch every once in a while where he'll hit these crazy hooks that you don't expect. And actually, like, you know, I think he had like one game this year where he just had like 25 points and it was all on those type of plays. But overall, the numbers on post-ups are not good, averaging around 0.7 points per possessions, which of course is horrendous, you know, very low percentile there, shooting 42% on his post-ups. And then of course, if you get beat, you can just foul him because he's not a good free throw shooter, and that goes into some of the inefficiency numbers as well. But even when he doesn't get fouled, only be shooting 42% on those plays, like, it's not an efficient option. Like, you shouldn't be going to him in the post. He's not really a skilled player. He doesn't have a turnaround jumper. Either he's unable to or not willing to work hard enough to get really, really deep post position, which he probably should be able to get given his size and to just go up and dunk on people, you know, like that as well. So, and I think he also even could stand to just cut up a little bit and improve his explosiveness. He hasn't looked like he's getting up quite as high. And if he's putting on a little bit of weight already at this point in his career, and remember, he's got that new contract now, so not a ton of incentive over the next 4 years. He's going to be making, you know, over $25 million a year. I could very easily see him not improving that much. Let's talk about this one quickly. How would we assess Stan Van Gundy's tenure in light of this season? I think we felt very positively about him going into the season. They have been a bit of a disappointment so far. Some of his big acquisitions, Reggie Jackson in particular, have disappointed this season. How are you feeling about the job that he's done now 3 years into that five-year, $35 million contract that he took when he was at one point the Warriors' first choice, and he went to Detroit because he could have personnel power?
I think he's done a shockingly good job as a team president. Like, they've done a good job of getting something for very little. Tobias Harris is a value contract at this point. He really helped them. They didn't really give up much of substance in that deal, expiring contracts, and then the pseudo expiring contract of Ersan Ilyasova. Similar story with Marcus Morris, who I think has really helped them and has, I think, separated from some of the issues that plagued him and his twin brother in Phoenix. And so I think that he has done reasonably well. I mean, we'll see how the money to Drummond turns out and with Reggie. But, and as a coach, I think that their defense, they've played reasonably well. But a big part of what their kind of whole existence was predicated on was, did they have enough offensive talent to really be a competitive team? And while in most circumstances, you wouldn't blame the coach for that, because I feel like they've kind of gone on the wrong side of that ledger, when the coach is the GM, whichever way it happens, it's him.
I would give him like an A minus for trades. I think he's won pretty much every trade that he's done. Signings, probably about a C, maybe even a C minus. I think every signing that he's had, whether it's re-signing his own guys or not, it was probably an overpay. I mean, they did do a good job at getting Drummond to wait and sign his max contract so that they could use cap space last summer. Didn't necessarily get many difference makers with that cap space. And I thought Reggie looked good. And I think a lot of his problems this year have been injury related, which I don't put on Van Gundy necessarily as team president. Certainly, you know, I think overall he's done well. I mean, how are they supposed, given the state of things when he came in, I think they're moving along reasonably well here. We'll see what happens now if they get kind of into luxury tax hell. I mean, boy, Boban is not really looking that good. John Lewis is like, okay, those contracts could just keep getting worse. They could get into the tax. KCP, they're probably going to end up having to max him out. That's not going
to
help.
But something I wanted to ask you is drafting.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that, thank you. That's when I paused there, I was like trying to think of the third thing I got brought up. Yeah. I mean, Stanley Johnson has had a few moments. I liked that pick at the time. You know, not a great pick, but they weren't going to draft Miles Turner. Nobody was talking about Devin Booker in that range. I mean, Trey Lyles. I mean, it was basically just like drafting Stanley over Justice Winslow. I think that's been defensible, even if Stanley has kind of been a pain in the ass there. I think he's flashed some a little bit lately. The Ellinson pick is not looking good. I know neither you nor I cared for that one. Especially when Malik Beasley went one pick after him. So I didn't like that too much, but you know, we could be wrong on that. I still just don't see a way that Ellinson has, even if he gets to be good at the things he's supposedly good at, gets to like fit into the modern NBA very well. So, I mean, overall, I think he's done fine.
Well, and also they haven't gotten much value from their seconds.
Michael Beneger hasn't really shown anything. He's old already.
Darren Hilliard.
That's a good point too. So I wouldn't necessarily be trying to give him an extension just yet. I see how next year goes for that. And then if you're really just, they stagnate again, maybe it would just be time for everyone to move on because you're not really going to get any further. I like the fact that they have this idea where they're going to watch every game and, really just like put eyes that he trusts on every NBA game. I think that can be, if you really have a disciplined way of looking at it, can be very useful, as much so perhaps as analytics are. I think that's, I would give him overall kind of like a B minus in the job that he's done so far as team president, maybe even a B.
Yeah, I was thinking straight B personally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure, other than just the signings, I'm not really sure how I would have done much better than what he's doing in terms of looking at each decision.
But that's,
I guess,
really
the Josh Smith thing as well.
Oh, you know, yeah. Still,
but I mean, when you consider how bad Smith has been since then, it's kind of like, you know, the guy wasn't worth anything. You know, it's not like he was killing it lately.
And you also have to consider the idea, I harp on this with some frequency, but it's important, that cap space is not equal to every team. And we already saw with Detroit, yeah, they deserve credit for Andre Drummond waiting to sign and they got money with that, but it's not like they're killing it with free agents, they're squeezing everything. They've actually done a far better job with trades, which is a huge thing for less desirable free agent locales to do. Like, he's nailed that part of it. I would say, off the top of my head, better than almost any other team in that mold right now. And that's a good thing. So I don't think that Josh Smith, obviously it was like a poor kind of use of resources and leverage, but I don't think it was that damning for what they were really going after.
Well, Danny, cap space may not be equal for every team, but it is equal for every Dunked On listener with our sponsors, CISO. You can sign up for 1 month free using the cap space code and use that cap space code with stamps.com as well to support the program. Let them know that you came from us. Thanks so much for listening. We will be back with part two of this likely tomorrow. Look forward to talking to you then. Oh, and also, I'm going to be doing the Twitter NBA show second screen by myself, it looks like, tonight, because Danny has other responsibilities. 10:30 Eastern, 7:30 Pacific for Bucks Clippers. I'm going to be doing that one by my lonesome. So check in, ask some questions on Periscope, and probably get them answered, because it's going to be late at night and not that many people are watching, but it'll still be fun to do. So we're doing it. Talk to y'all next time.